welcome again, I should say. This is the double dose, a double helping of the podcast here on Bright Side of the Sun here this week. If you just got done listening to Dave and I chat about our different philosophy differences in terms of who the Sun should start at the 3 and the 4 and Media Day and Lon Babbie and a lot of the stuff that we were able to get from the Suns before they headed out of training camp, jump over, check that out. If you already listened to it, this is part two where we're actually going to have another Bright Side writer coming on, Sreeker, who has a pseudonym Richard Parker, as he had on there for a little while, but I know he's changed that recently. And, you know, I wanted to definitely have you on for two reasons. One, because we're rotating the staff this year, and we want to have everybody on so their voice can be heard, as well as, you know, read, obviously, on Bright Side, but also get your voice heard. And then also, at the end of this call, letting everybody know, probably at about the 20-ish minute mark, we're going to jump into Breaking Bad. It's been 72 hours since the finale aired. We're not TV critics, but I'm critical of those who are fans of the show. If you haven't watched it by now, then you deserve to be spoiled, but I'm letting you know ahead of time, about 20 minutes or so into the call, we're gonna jump into talking a little bit of Breaking Bad, because I know it's something that me and Sreeker have had some fun conversations through email and tweets. But long intro aside, Sreeker, how are you doing today? It's a Wednesday morning. People are listening to this, and the Suns are at training camp, and basketball is on the horizon.
I'm feeling great for those exact reasons that you mentioned, Chris. NBA is back. Suns basketball is back. Can't wait to talk Suns ball and Breaking Bad. It's really two of my favorite things.
Yeah, there you go. You know what? And to be honest, I mean, this summer, it's definitely been, those have been the two main things, other than I'll influx a little bit of Phoenix Mercury in there for covering the team over the summer, but that's been, Yeah, that's been my summer as well, is just kind of enjoying Breaking Bad and then getting attacked for my my slight criticism of the show here and there, but we'll talk about that as we go through. But let's introduce yourself a little bit. I know you had your profile, and you introduced yourself when you jumped on the site, but talk about your background and how you came to watching and appreciating the Phoenix Suns and now being over here on the Bright Side.
Yeah, definitely. Well, for those who missed Chris's great introduction, I am the artist formerly known as Richard Parker. My name is Sreeker. And I actually started writing for the Bright Side not too long ago, a few months ago, I think April it was. And that just came about because I have been reading it for years, to be honest, and just really wanted to jump in. And to be totally honest, it was actually a product of finals time in my senior year in college. And I, being the procrastinator that I am, I really just wanted to write about Suns basketball, not write about, you know, my economics courses. So I did that, and it started getting more active, and just started to write after Dave asked me to write some more, and I just continued, and it's been great. And the reason I'm a Suns fan, I'm actually, this is a sort of embarrassing fact about me, I've only been to Phoenix once, and that was in the airport for a transit stop. Never actually left the airport in Phoenix. But I went to college in Atlanta, live in the Bay Area in California right now, and I have always lived here, actually, other than my college years. But the first time I ever saw a basketball game was a Phoenix Suns game in 2005, the playoffs, the game where Steve Nash scored, I think, 48 points to beat the Mavericks, and I think it was game 4 or 5, but after that I was hooked and just became more and more of a fan.
Yeah, that's a polite introduction to basketball, seeing a guy like Steve Nash, fresh off of a couple of MVPs, put up those kind of numbers against his former team. And yeah, those were some exciting series, watching the Suns and the Mavs, or anything to do with the Suns and the Mavs during the meat of the 2000s there, or the aughts, as they're called, watching them play in the playoffs. So, yeah, no, we love having you on here. Speaking of the Bay Area, for some odd reason, my guy from EuroLeague Adventures, Sam Meyerkamp, and Joe Kaiser from ESPN, two guys that I do consistent podcasts with on NBADraftInsider.com, both Bay Area guys, and it just seems like almost everybody lives in the Bay Area or New York. There's not a lot of writing going on in Phoenix, so your experience with Phoenix is like mine with Minnesota. I pass through it with the airport, and that's the only experience I have with that.
That's actually funny, because I actually have more experience with Minnesota than I do in Phoenix, and I've actually been there for about a week or so in the past, a few years ago.
Yeah, no, it's the polar opposite of Phoenix. So if you want to get a feel for what it was like out there in Minnesota, it's the polar opposite of what it's out, and you know, no pun intended with it being super cold out there in Minnesota. But Yeah, no, I mean, it's great to have you on. Like, one thing is, like, when you first came on, I appreciated reading your takes and as you're coming on and doing the write-ups that you were doing, but more importantly, I think, and a little bit more to the point with you, is that I've really appreciated the work you've done here over the summer. You had a great opportunity to, you didn't jump on immediately and say, I want to talk to Ryan McDonough and Lon Babbitt. You took the opportunity to get to know some of the Suns' assistants and had some sit-downs with them, as well as their rookies. So talk about your summer and how you just kind of got baptized by fire with four pretty potent interviews and being able to dive deep into the Suns.
Yeah, and that actually was a really good experience because initially the stories I wrote and the articles I really focused on were mostly cap-related or analysis-related. I really like doing the cap breakdowns and the capology pieces, as I like to call them, for the Suns. And thankfully, the Suns were quite active this summer, so the cap situation was constantly in flux, constantly changing. So it was fun to sort of break that down and do that whole deal. But then after a while, I realized Right Side of the Sun really has it is a fantastic platform for fans to just learn about the team, and also for the writers, and for someone like me who writes from the perspective of a fan, and who wants to be more educated. So I just took the initiative to sort of reach out for a couple interviews in the beginning, and the Suns communications team was really great and got back to me right away to schedule that interview with the assistant coach, Mike Longobardi, and he was great on the phone. It was a really good experience for me. My first real moment interviewing anyone, to be honest, not being interviewed to be actually interviewing someone. So that was great. And then recently, in the past couple of weeks, talking to the two rookies, Alex Len and Archie Goodwin, was a really, really awesome experience because from the perspective of someone it sounds weird to say that they put a lot of things in context, because I'm actually older than them, and I consider myself to be young. I'm 21. So I was really just impressed with how confident both of them seemed to be, especially Archie, and how polite they really were. Alex was a really, really, really polite interview. And the best thing about those two guys was that they gave really thoughtful, detailed answers to every question and didn't just stop after one word or one sentence and just really give thorough answers. And I probably was more rusty on the phone than they were, which is really great for Suns fans, because they're probably going to be quite the interviewers in their future.
Yeah, and one thing that, like, I'll go to high school tournaments here and there with, catching up with the talent and talking to Archie Goodwin 2 years before he's putting on an NBA uniform, getting to know these guys before they head off into college. And it's always felt weird, and you could probably agree with this to an extent, but when you walk up to someone as an adult and you kind of forget, like, in your mind, this is basketball player. I'm talking to basketball player. And you forget that someone like Archie Goodwin, 19 years old when you talk to him. First time I ever talked to him, he was like 17. He might have even been 16, turning 17. And I just kind of felt like an idiot talking to them and asking them these like deep, profound type questions. And I mean, really, all it was, how are you getting better and where do you want to go to school and blah blah blah. But yeah, it's always an interesting thing when you go up to these guys and you put it into context, going, this kid's 19 years old. Like, it's pretty astounding that I'm interviewing a 19-year-old, and the fact that they have these, thought out, thorough answers. They're real thoughtful people if you ask them the right kind of questions. And you start to kind of realize that these people are more than just guys that dribble a ball and shoot it up in the air. They actually have some thoughts. Mm-hmm. They're pretty intelligent guys.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably one of the biggest aspects that I enjoyed from interviewing those two guys was that, these guys are younger than me. They gave really eloquent, like, thoughtful answers. And that really is a big part of just being a professional athlete. You don't really think about that, but having to do this all the time, you have to be good at it. And at such a young age, it's a good thing that Archie Goodwin at 19 years old and Alex Len at 20 are already seem to be pretty good at it. And that's always good. And they were really friendly too, and which is always nice.
Yeah, the biggest takeaway I get from Archie Goodwin is that, not when you talk to him necessarily, but when you, like, you actually meet him, he physically is every much a 19-year-old as you're going to find. I mean, LeBron at 19 years old was a truck, and, you looked at him and you could have, like Greg Oden and those guys, you can make the jokes that they're, 19 going on 30. But with Archie Goodwin, he was genuinely 19 going on, 20. He looks the part of a young kid that's got to, get up there and mature, and, physically mature, I should say. And, you know, like I said, it's real interesting when you start talking to them and seeing how deep these guys are. So you mentioned, you know, doing the Capology stuff, and that's actually the stuff that I was reading that I talked to you about before, mentioned that, you know, that was the stuff I enjoyed reading because I don't pretend to know the numbers as well as I probably should or could. And you and Dave do a good job, you know, bouncing back and forth on the Capology and getting to know what's going on with the Suns. As you were doing those, like, what was your feel, like, as you're seeing, like, these different moves being made and tweaks and the numbers kind of adjusting and kind of seeing the plan? I mean, did you start to kind of appreciate a little bit more, not only with the way they're drafting, but with the way they're managing the roster and the money, kind of appreciating how a team is put together and what Ryan McDonough was able to do dramatically in the past, 5 months? I think he's been on board maybe, 4 to 6 months overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I gained, you know, quite an appreciation for what they were doing by looking more at the exact cap situation, how that was changing. You know, Chris, coming from an economics major perspective, I tend to think analytically. So that's really the reason I enjoy looking at these sort of numbers and these these cap figures, et cetera, salary figures. So breaking that down was really not only was it fun for me, but it was actually useful to be able to, because I was learning constantly while doing that, you know, oh wow, I hadn't thought about this situation with the cap before. I didn't realize that they got out better this way. For example, the Caron Butler trade was basically an entire salary dump, and what that did was just negate the effect of having to add on $8 million of salary through the Jared Dudley Eric Bledsoe trade. So essentially, the end result was Jared Dudley and a second-round pick for Eric Bledsoe, you know, Kravtsov, Ish Smith, and, you know, a whole lot less salary. And so the fact that the Suns were really just able to keep their salary figure where it was at the beginning of the summer, and but at the same time push towards a younger core and acquire guys like Eric Bledsoe and, you know, keep their flexibility for the future. That's one thing I always stressed in these cap pieces that I wrote, was it was all about flexibility. And that's something that I think we'll continue to see throughout the season, whether it be through a Marcin Gortat trade or anything like that. But flexibility will absolutely play a huge part of every move the Suns make. And Ryan McDonough's done a really good job of maintaining that so far.
Yeah, and he's also, in being able to bring in a guy that knows basketball like Ryan does, they were able to let Lon Babby, a guy who, you know, not too long ago, you know, a wink and a nod to not too long ago, was in your position, you know, a kid coming out of college, probably economics or pre-law type major, knows numbers, and was, you know, was a lawyer slash agent for all those years, and now lets Lon slide right back into his comfort seat versus sitting between the comfort seat and the uncomfort seat and kind of being, I don't want to say indecisive, but he wasn't really in his element, and now he's able to say, as Dave and I kind of put it as bluntly as possible, Ryan, go find the guys and then tell me their value, and then I'll negotiate what they're worth. And that's kind of what Lon's role is able to be now. And so the next thing I want to talk to you about and kind of bring this up, and I don't want to go into too much of a knock on it because, you know, people have their opinions, but so Grantland and Bill Simmons, they're rolling out YouTube clips for ranking the 30 NBA teams. They're starting at the bottom and they're moving to the top, obviously. So they'll go from Philly to Miami, I would imagine, and then 28 other teams in between. The Suns popped up at number 29, and two of the same old tired rhetorics were brought up with the Phoenix Suns, one in which Robert Sarver's a penny-pinching, terrible owner, sell the team, we hate you, which was, if you watch the video, there was no quibs given between Jalen and Bill Simmons on that notion, and then also that the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar Neil Walk issue is something that has plagued the franchise since the beginning. So the two old, most tired rhetorics ever for the Phoenix Suns were basically just like the beginning and the end of that YouTube video. But then the rest of it was a lot of truth, you know, talking about the roster and their future and going forward, and being 29th in the NBA is probably in the window of where they're going to be. What did you think overall of that video? I mean, did you think it was fair? And like the Robert Sarver stuff, I mean, as a numbers guy, obviously the numbers, it's not as much as what people say. He doesn't spend money, but then again, you know, obviously there's some flack that he's got to be taken.
Yeah, well, first of all, about the video itself, the Grantland preview, you're right. Actually, a lot of it was accurate. A lot of it was spot on, but there were definitely parts that really were not as accurate as they made it out to be. For example, the stuff that was right, I think 29th is probably a very good spot for the Suns to be. I think they're not nearly as bad as you know, Philadelphia is just way ahead in terms of the tank race with the roster they have right now. So 29th is fair for the Suns. And also just their evaluation of the roster was mostly fair. Had a couple issues with what sort of trades Bill Simmons, as he's known to do, is just throwing out with for Dragic to the Thunder. But that's besides the point. Anyway, the biggest issue, like you mentioned, was a Robert Sarver is a cheapskate notion that they basically played out throughout the interview with their little clips and whatnot. And that's really, as you pretty much just described, that's really an issue that a lot of people seem to agree with, but it's not necessarily true. First of all, like you said, if you look at the numbers, the Suns were, you know, obviously paying a good amount on their payroll in the years that they were competitive from 2004 through, you know, even 2010, which in 2010 I bring up purposefully because that's really the biggest issue. The biggest mistake I think Robert Sarver has made was that he spent a lot of money, but he spent it in the absolute worst way possible on mediocre talent, like, you know, Josh Childress acquiring Hero Turkoglu and whatnot. Every Suns fan knows that. I don't need to go through that again. And between that and some of the draft picks, he's earned that label. But really, I don't think it's fair to just call him a cheapskate without really looking at the, you know, the payroll and where the Suns have ranked, which they have not been low in terms of overall payroll in the last decade. And also, like, and you mentioned this earlier, but and you know a lot more about this than I do, I'm sure. But behind the scenes, I'm sure the Suns franchise is known to pay a lot for their, whether it be in their front office, the analytic platform. They're always ahead of the race in terms of health and, you know, their physical doctor, player doctors and whatnot. So he does a lot for the team. He does pay, but he definitely gets a bad rap. And I don't think that's going to end anytime soon unless, you know, the Suns start being competitive while he's the owner. And that may be a couple years away.
Yeah, and that's, I think that the way that fans and national media measure an owner, quote unquote, spending money is how many max contracts are they giving out and mm-hmm. how far above the cap are they willing to go to compete for a championship, which in some scenarios, I mean, would it make any sense for Philly to have gone out there and offered like a max deal to Josh Smith and then offer a max deal to someone else and, you know, middle around in mediocrity like teams like, you know, Phoenix has over the years and Utah and Milwaukee. Do you want to middle in that purgatory of mediocrity in the NBA, which is probably the worst place you can be in any of the four major sports, is in that, like, you know, 8 to 10 range, 7 to 10 range in a conference. You're never going to get to a championship level and you're never going to get bad enough to get talent. So that's kind of where the Suns are at. They're not giving out max contracts. They're not overpaying for guys when they should. I mean, in hindsight, the Amar'e Stoudemire move was brilliant, and in hindsight, the Steve Nash move from a health perspective might end up being brilliant when we look back at it in a few years, like if he only gets on the court for like 12 games in 3 years. But,
right.
I mean, with Steve Nash, I agree with the notion of he should have retired as a Phoenix Sun. I get that. I completely understand that. But you also have to start your rebuild at some point in time. They let it go all the way to basically the end of the contract, and then they sent him where he wanted to go. They gave him his happy ending. But yeah, I mean, the notion that because he's not giving out max contracts and spending over the cap and paying luxury tax, that's not something this team needs to do, especially the last 3 to 4 years when they weren't a competitive team outside of 2010's miracle run to the Western Conference Finals. This is not a team that's competing for a championship, so you shouldn't be, you know, competing with teams for max deals for, you know, average talents. You got to build through the draft like they're doing, which I genuinely appreciate.
Right, exactly. And yeah, exactly. I don't think now is a fair time to criticize him for being cheap because look at the roster he has. I mean, where is the team headed? The team's headed, you know, down the road in a year or two for probably a good future, or some fans hope. But right now, there's really no point in spending or trying to spend as much. And to be fair, the team attempted to do that last summer as well, and some fans obviously know how that ended up. You know, and if we had gotten Eric Gordon, who knows where the team would be, really. I have no clue, but the payroll would pretty much be stuck, and that probably would not have been a good thing, because once again, it's about flexibility at this point. And paying and spending just for the sake of spending as an owner really is not the greatest idea. And especially for a mid-market team like Phoenix, obviously it seems like the Lakers and Knicks can continue to spend and continue to give up assets for players like Andrea Bargnani, but, you know, the Phoenix Suns are rebuilding. They need to rebuild slowly and through the draft, like you said. And I think they've started doing that this summer, and it's going to be a process, but they're on the right track.
Yeah, and I mean, with last year in specific, with Goran and Dave, if you're listening, Goran Dragic. I'm working phonetically to say his name correctly because I've brutalized his name
Thank
for
you.
Years. So yeah, I'm phonetically going through the process. I got Channing Frye down. That one's good. I'm good to go. I've always said that one right, but then again, I probably shouldn't have ever said that one wrong if I ever have.
If you can get my name right, you should definitely be able to get Dragic right.
Well, just and we kind of broke this down probably way longer than we ever should have on the part one of the podcast. But just the double meaning of the letter G, how you can say that in different ways, has always just thrown me off, and that's why I end up saying his name wrong. I try to pronounce it like an international player, and then I realize I'm doing it wrong. But no, like to go back to Goran, I mean, they signed him to an amazing deal. I mean, if you think about it, that's
yeah.
extreme value for what you get for him. That's, I'm not saying he deserves $10 million a year, but I mean, at 7.5 a year, and you get to have him for 4 years, basically with that player option at the end, you know, Marcin Gortat
yeah.
at seven a year as a guy that's a very tradable asset. So as you mentioned, like with Bill Simmons, he throws out those trade machine type trades. And, you know, he had mentioned maybe Gortat and Dragic going to, or Dragic going to like OKC for some kind of a package. And, you know, those are kind of things that you can do now because you created flexibility. You have good contracts. You have good players that other teams might want.
Yeah.
So that's what I think they've done. I think they've done it masterfully in respect to having at least some guys they can trade out. I mean, would you want the roster to be more talented? Sure, but that'll come in the next couple of years, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And, I'm glad you alluded to that fact because, they did spend last summer, but there really isn't, after Michael Beasley, who's now gone, there really isn't a crippling contract on the team anymore. There really isn't even a bad contract on the team. I mean, you could argue maybe Channing Frye at 6.8, but there is value in that contract for two more years, including that player option, because if he returns to health, I mean, he, you know, as a big who can space the floor, I don't mean to keep bringing up Bargnani, but as the Knicks showed the rest of the world this offseason, that there obviously is a market for even a horrendous shooter who can space the floor as a big. But and Channing Frye is a better player than Bargnani on a better deal. So I think there's a market for him if he returns to health as well. So there really isn't a bad contract on the roster. And they're set up well for the future, and I think they're going to be all right in 2014 or 15.
I think so. Now, quick question, quick answer. Worst contract, and I know that we're immediately feeling the Michael Beasley that's going on right now, but worst contract, Michael Beasley, Josh Childress, Hakeem Warrick, or Hedo Turkoglu? Of those four, which one is the worst contract in the past 10 years?
That's tricky. For the Suns specifically?
Yeah, for the Suns specifically, yeah.
So acquiring Hedo, because they didn't give him that contract. But
that's
I think
true.
Josh Childress, to be honest, because that was a big long-term deal that didn't have a sort of out, you know, it wasn't partially guaranteed in the third year like Michael Beasley's was. Warrick they got rid of because it was, you know, cheaper than the others. It was about $4 million or so. Hedo they managed to get rid of, thankfully, in less than a year. And they actually managed to get Marcin Gortat out of it. So I don't really hold too much against that, even though that was a terrible, terrible decision to trade for him and pay him $10 or $11 million that year. But, I definitely think Josh Childress, just because that never worked out. That never even, you know, from the very beginning, that was a failure, pretty much. And they gave him that $6 to $7 million a year for 4 years. And, you know, that ever since, it was just a bad fit from the very, very beginning, and it just didn't work out. With Beasley, at least, they got rid of him after 1 year. Childress is still counting against us. I mean, he's not counting against the cap because he's empty, but Sarver's still paying him. And once again, that's another example of Sarver not being cheap.
Yeah, there you go. He's still opening up the paycheck for a guy that played a few games for Brooklyn last year. So,
exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy how they backed up the money truck for a guy that made about $30, $31 million overall for his career. They basically backed up the money truck and gave him two-thirds of that. I mean, they gave him a $20 million contract for, serviceable player. But just, yeah, as you said, right from the jump, just ended up not making any sense, didn't click, didn't work, didn't provide anything. I think that's interesting. I think in the moment, a lot of people are going to say Michael Beasley because it's in the moment. And, you know, when you actually sit down and you think about it, then you can kind of, you start to realize how bad the Josh Childress one was. And And not to use that analogy too hardcore, because I don't want to make it come off as one person is right and one person is wrong, but to switch gears, you know, in the moment, everybody is talking about Breaking Bad as being the best show of all time. And with hindsight, looking back and being able to look at some other things, you know, you can probably find some other stuff. But as we talked about a little bit on Twitter the night of, and as we talked about back and forth, I thought this season, I'm going to preface this a little bit. This season I thought was fantastic. It was arguably the best final season of a TV show that I've seen in general. Like from start to finish, it was the best final season of a TV show. But I just think a lot of the whole living in the moment and Breaking Bad is the it thing right now. You know, people criticize it with kid gloves a little bit, and that it's a show that people are in the moment now, you know, applauding and calling the greatest show of all time while forgetting that there's been some pretty amazing television over the past decade. But I want to get your opinion. So you've had to digest the finale. I haven't digested it. I've eaten it, spitting it out, chewed it, and watched it probably about seven times since it's been over, because I'm kind of a little bit overly obsessed with things. What did you finish with? Where are you at today now with the way everything ended with Felina, the finale?
Yeah, I actually enjoyed the finale very much. To preface this, if it wasn't clear from the way Chris described it, I'm a huge Breaking Bad fan. so it'll be interesting. But no, I really enjoyed the finale. I mean, I don't think it was the best episode by any means, but the best episode of Breaking Bad by any means, but it was good. I mean, there really was nothing that jumped out to me as a flaw, but the only thing that it was a bit, I don't want to come off as a, you know, a pessimist, but it was almost a too happy of an ending. You know, it was unexpected. It was surprisingly happy for Breaking Bad, especially when comparing it to, you know, their Breaking Bad's normal scale of darkness. But it seemed like they tried a little too hard to tie every loose, answer every question, tie everything up with a nice bow. And they did a good job of that. They accomplished that, and there's no really no loose ends at the end of the show, which is always nice. But it was really tidy. Tidy is a word I keep saying to being used to describe that episode. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, just an observation. But I enjoyed it, and I think it was a fitting ending to, you know, to the show and Walter White's legacy and character and whatnot.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of people probably lose focus on, is that it was the right ending for that show in particular. Because, I mean, when you think about it, the way they ended it is almost the same way of all of the episodes that everybody loves the most of the show. The train robbery episode, the, you know, getting all the full measure with getting everybody taken out in prison all at once, and, you know, killing of Gus Fring. The way that they end the show is it fits in line with everything from the very first episode, how Walter White comes up with a plan. It kind of backfires a little bit on him, but at the end of the day, he ends up being kind of the smartest guy in the room. So I think that it's a very fitting ending for the show. My only issue, and we talked about this a little bit, it felt like it was like 10 scenes, like 10 moments in the show versus kind of like a fluid episode that we're more used to. Mm-hmm. It was just like, you know, resolve this, then resolve that, then resolve this, then resolve that. But yeah, overall, I don't judge the finale for the finale. I want to judge the show for the show, and I think it was fantastic. I think the show, you know, goes in my pantheon of somewhere between like 3 and 5 of all the shows that I've seen ever. I won't immediately crown it the best show, because I still have some loyalty and admiration for like The Wire and The Shield and even Mad Men that's going on right now, which I think is fantastic. And, you know, Sopranos, a lot of shows that, you know, I know you mentioned you haven't seen, so I won't criticize you for not liking those shows more because you haven't seen them. I thought it was great. I thought it was a good fitting ending. A lot of things that I read that I appreciated was that Vince Gilligan, you know, said that Ozymandias was the best episode they've ever produced, directed, put together. And one of the writers, I think it was Emily Nussbaum from the New York Times, if I mispronounced her name, I'm sorry, Goran Dragic, but with Emily Nussbaum there. But she had mentioned that, you know, maybe Walt just died in the car, you know, before the keys fell down to him, and everything that happened was like a dream sequence for him. And there was another thing that I also read that basically said that they ended the final three episodes where they gave you a finale for whatever type of fan you are with those final three episodes. You have your action episode with Ozymandias. You have your kind of like thoughtful Walter White being punished episode with Granite State. And then you have your tidy ending there with Felina. So I what did you think of those two things that I just mentioned? I don't know if you had a chance to read a lot about the finale.
Right. I hadn't heard of the New York Times I guess the writer who said that that it might have all been a dream. I hadn't even thought about that. I mean, I don't think I agree with it, but I could see that as being a sort of interpretation. I mean, I didn't. That's interesting. I'll have to give that some more thought. But yeah, I agree with Vince Gilligan that Ozymandias was one of the best episodes ever on the show, if not one of, I mean, if not the best. But, and I actually thought that that episode felt like the finale of the show, and then the last two episodes were sort of an epilogue, really, that really tied everything together after that, you know, big, that finale that everyone loved. And, which is nice, which was needed, so I'm glad it ended the way it did. But yeah, Ozymandias, I think, was definitely my favorite. And that's a good point that that you brought up with the three different finales. I hadn't thought about that either, and that actually makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know if it was, they intentionally wanted to cater to every single fan by making three different types of episodes, or if it just played out that way because of the story. I don't remember, no, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And like I was saying, I think Ozymandias was really the finale for the show, and that the epilogue was just, you know, what followed to tie up Walter White's life and, you know, obviously kill him off.
What, for you personally, as a guy that watched, now, question for you, did you watch these shows in sequence like real life, or did you kind of binge watch most of them on Netflix and then catch the final season live?
Oh, no, I watched the first four and a half seasons this summer. I hadn't watched Breaking Bad till this summer, and I mean, I wanted to watch it because I've heard so many good things about it. So I started watching it. I wanted to watch it to catch up for this you know, this final half season. And so I started watching it, I think, in June. So I was hoping to catch up by the end of the summer. I ended up finishing for four and a half seasons in, I think, 1.5 or 2 weeks, and then was left just wishing that August 10th or whenever this new season started to hurry up so I can, you know, get back on. Because after binge-watching Breaking Bad for 2 weeks, it was hard to not watch it and await it for, you know, the next 2 months. But, yeah, that was really my foray into Breaking Bad. And so this last half season was the only time I really watched it live.
So the reason I wanted to ask that was to kind of get your take on the ending. As you mentioned, they tied up all the loose ends that I think that they felt were important loose ends, because obviously you can nitpick and you can say, well, what about the money? And then what about, like, you know, did they actually give Flynn the money, or did they go to the DEA? You know, did, you know, what happened with, like, the Czech Republic? What happened with the Chileans that, you know, Gustavo Fring was connected to? So there's miscellaneous loose ends, obviously.
Right.
You know, what happens with Jesse after he doesn't yell, yeah, bitch, in the car? He just yells, which I thought was satisfying, but at the same time, just wanted to hear it one last time.
It would have been so ridiculous had he yelled it in that scene.
It would have been, right, that's what I was saying. Like, in hindsight, I'm like, that would have been ridiculous. It would have been very cartoonish if he would have yelled it there versus just, you know, being in that moment temporarily insane because he's finally free. But no, the question is, were you satisfied with Aaron Paul's character of Jesse Pinkman basically being the beacon of light at the end of the show with everybody else falling down when he was the guy that was written off in the finale of season one? Were you satisfied with him being the one that got to ride off on the El Camino or White Horse?
Yeah, I actually was rooting for Jesse throughout this last half season because I understand that he deserved because it wasn't like he was totally innocent. I mean, he killed people. He was but like, he really was the good guy in the show, to be honest. You start out in the beginning of the show, and for me, it's easy to reflect because I'd seen everything just a couple months ago. But at the beginning of the show, I remember specifically thinking when they introduced this character, I was like, oh man, this druggy guy teaming up with this teacher, you know, I don't really see a reason to root for him. And then they slowly give you little, you know, details into his character, like how he is with kids, like his family, his brother, etc. And he really, really grows. He really grew on me, at least. And so he was almost like I could forgive the things he did wrong because unlike Walter White, he actually repented for them. He actually really felt the anguish throughout this whole last half season. It was quite obvious And obviously after, you know, Todd or that whole gang enslaved him pretty much, like, he suffered for the last 4 months. And I think he did it. That was basically his time, and he deserved to sort of ride off into the, like you said, ride off into the night and drive into the new Need for Speed movie.
He literally drove right onto that trailer. That was kind of, and what's funny is with the Need for Speed trailer, I kind of noticed that his character was a little beaten up during his little monologue before they panned over to his face. And I was like, is that literally Jesse? That he that's the best backstory for any video game character ever, was that Jesse Pinkman is the backstory for whoever you were in Need for Speed. And he's got all that pent up inside him, and now he's going to go and race cars. So
That would be fantastic. Yeah, if they were smart, they would market it that way.
Yeah, and everyone joked that because they brought on, her name's escaping me because I'm not a TV critic, but the lady that played Malcolm in the Middle's mom came on as a show producer in season 4 or season 5 for like an episode, and everyone joked that this was all just a prequel, and then the family's going to go into witness protection, and it starts up Malcolm in the Middle. It'd be even better if it started up Need for Speed again. It would top Doom and all those other terrible video game movies. But yeah, no, like I said, overall, really appreciated the show. Thought it was great. Figured that, you know, since having you on the podcast, it made a lot of sense to talk about it. So two basketball guys rambling about a TV show, who cares? You know, I had to get it off my chest and verbalize a lot of the stuff.
Absolutely.
So yeah, and so question for you, with, and this is more of a society type question. When did it become, and I talked about this with Dave a little bit, when did it become, whether you want to call them fanboys or just, you know, people that are really into something, when did it become an issue when someone called something top 3 or 5 or 10 of all time, to the point where people were actually insulted because you didn't just immediately latch on and say it was the best ever because that's what they enjoyed? When did that become part of the philosophy of society today? Because that kind of bugs me a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good question, because, I mean, I try not to do that. I put everything relatively, and like I sort of look at it from my personal perspective. Breaking Bad's the best show I've ever seen, but I understand, and I tell people that I haven't seen a lot of these, you know, the supposed best shows of all time. I haven't seen The Sopranos. I've only seen 2 seasons of The Wire, still have 3 to go. So I'm obviously not going to say Breaking Bad's the best show ever. It's the best show I've seen. So that's the way I try to phrase things. And it does, I agree with you that it does sort of annoy me, and I see that a lot. And I think, I mean, when people just talk about something being the best thing ever or the worst thing ever, there's no middle ground, pretty much. And I think that's a big result of the internet. I mean, just the internet culture, really, is that people can, you know, latch onto these things and, you know, proclaim their love for something more and more easily, pretty much, online. And They don't really have to back it up with any facts. If they just say something's the best thing ever or the worst thing ever, they can just, you know, say it, and that's pretty much all there is to. I mean, they don't have to back it up because they're not actually conversing with someone. They don't actually have to point to any facts.
Yeah,
I think it's just because it's easier to just tweet about it and just say, "Hell, man, best show ever." The end. That's it. No question. No argument.
Yeah. Or just tweet at some movie critic and just say like a sentence that has no backbone, like you're saying, and then a hashtag, and then you feel satisfied because you told off that guy who probably got 50 other tweets and didn't even read yours. But yeah, it's just kind of comical. Like, because I put things, this is the way I react to things. I don't react to them like the Miami Heat just won the NBA Finals. It was amazing against the Spurs, but I didn't end it going best finals ever because, you know, I like to put things into contextual argument and be able to actually think about things a little bit more thoughtfully. And when you look at like Breaking Bad, again, I love it. It's probably in the top 3 to 5. I'd have to kind of sit down and think about it. But, you know, again, it's the shows that you've seen, it's the best for you. Shows that I've seen, it's in the top 3 to 5 for me, which is not an insult by no means. I would sit back and watch the 5.5 seasons or 6 seasons, whatever they want to call it, of Breaking Bad any day of the week over 90% of the garbage on TV today. So it's an amazing show, and contextually, top 3 to 5, you know, maybe I'll sit on it for a little while and be able to move it up the list. But if you've never seen Dexter, and spoiler alert for folks that haven't seen Dexter, good Lord, how that show ended. I mean, I've never seen a show go from genuine greatness for about 2 to 4 seasons to flat out just mediocrity to below average television for the final 4, and then probably the worst finale I've ever seen in my entire life. And I've watched probably about 2 dozen TV shows that are on like a high quality drama level. That's just, that show fell on its face. And with Breaking Bad, the great thing about it is consistency. It's been amazing consistently for 60-plus episodes in 5 years.
Yeah. No, I agree, and the consistency is really the big thing, because, like, there really isn't any episode that takes a dive that makes you lose interest. And for me, I know a lot of people for Breaking Bad, I mean, for any show, really, but even for Breaking Bad, a lot of people, it took them a couple episodes to get into it. But actually, and I heard that it would take me a couple episodes to get into it, but I actually was hooked after episode one. So and then I just watched the rest of it, and I never really lost interest in any single episode. And that was a really big thing for me. It's consistency in its writing, and basically the aura it held and the sense it held. So it was good. But like you said, again, I mean, the thing about ranking these things and like just proclaiming that something is the best thing ever and then arguing with someone if they disagree is that it's obviously that these sorts of arguments are all relative to the people that are arguing. If someone says it's the best show ever, they think it's the best show ever, but then when they start arguing that on someone like you who thinks it's a top five show ever, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me because, you know, like, it's a preference. I don't really get that. But again, I think that's a product of just being able to say whatever you want on platforms like Twitter and just use, you know, hashtags that you think are cool.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think people know how to use hashtags, so it's always kind of funny. It's like, hashtag, you don't know what you're talking about. It's like, well, there was only one of those hashtags today, so good for you with being able to hashtag that. I would definitely recommend, you know, if you really like Breaking Bad. What I love about AMC right now with their era, a lot of people speak highly of Walking Dead. I couldn't really get into that show, but the great thing... Yeah, I mean, the difference between Breaking Bad and Mad Men, and I don't want to go on a diatribe, we're going to get out of here in just a second, but the great thing about Mad Men and Breaking Bad is that they're both brilliantly written, but Breaking Bad is written brilliantly with their moments of silence, whereas Mad Men is brilliantly written with their elongated speeches. So, like, it's amazing how you have two shows that are probably the best written show. I'll say this. Those are two of the top three written shows I've ever seen in my life. I'll put those in the writing category and in the top two to three of shows I've ever seen in my time of watching television, but just written so differently and with just such rich either subtext or mannerisms like Breaking Bad has versus eloquent speeches that they give, you know, Jon Hamm's character, other characters. It's just brilliant writing on those two shows. So, yeah, that puts, you know, that's a... finale for Breaking Bad. That's we'll put an end to this one, but any wise words for the Brightsiders out there, and how can they follow you on Twitter if they don't already?
Yeah, follow me on Twitter. It's at Sreeker, my name, at Sreeker _ BSOTS. I just realized that's probably not a very catchy Twitter handle, but it is what it is. Follow me at Sreeker _ BSOTS. And every Brightsider should know what BSOTS stands for, so definitely. And, historically, I tweeted basically only NBA and Breaking Bad stuff, so mostly now that half of that is over, it'll mostly just be NBA stuff, so definitely follow me, and, tweet at me on Twitter.
Yeah, no, we're a very social bunch here on Brightside, and you might see me every now and then live tweeting a Friday Night Lights episode that is like 5 years old, because I'm getting myself through that through that show, which I'm not going to put an advertisement or an endorsement on. Really good through about 7 episodes, and it becomes 90210 in Texas is the way I've been describing it. So, appreciate you having on, Sreeker. I will start pronouncing your name and Goran's name correctly, Drag Itch. And that'll do it. That's episode 40. We'll catch you guys next week when the Suns are actually playing basketball. They'll be on the basketball court playing a game by the time the next time we come at you with episode 41.
All right. Thank you.